Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tom Nichols joins us now. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And he's got a new book out. It's titled The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Now, to get a better sense of what Nichols is worried about, listen to this excerpt from his book. He writes, quote, "I fear we are moving beyond a natural skepticism regarding expert claims to the death of the ideal of expertise itself, a Google-fueled, Wikipedia-based, blog-sodden collapse of any division between professionals and laypeople, teachers and students, knowers and wanderers, in other words, between those with achievement in an area and those with none." Well, Tom Nichols is in the studio with me. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
That excerpt makes it sound like you think that we're all going to die. Is it really that bad?
It's getting that bad. And I'm concerned about it, and I'm concerned about the effects not only on the well-being of the individual person when it comes to things like vaccines or diet or things like that, but I'm worried about the health of our republic. When people stop trusting the experts who have to advise the people who run a complicated superpower every day, our political process starts to fall apart, and I'm really concerned about that.
Okay, so give me one or two of, you think, the most potent examples of this mistrust or trust or death of expertise.
Well, at the micro level, the obvious case is vaccines. Doctors. When I started writing this, I should say a couple of things. First of all, I don't speak for the War College or the government. I'm representing my own view. And that this has nothing to do with the election or any recent events. I actually blogged this as a piece about 3 years ago and then turned it into a short article for a magazine. And I started to get a lot of letters, and many of them were from doctors. So doctors were one of the biggest constituencies for me writing this book, because they were so frustrated with not just the issues about vaccines, but with patients coming in and lecturing them about what kind of medications they needed, what sort of procedures. And then I started getting letters from lawyers. I even had one from a molecular biologist. So that on a micro level, that's one. On a macro level, the sense that people in my field, for example, diplomacy, foreign affairs, international relations, that we simply have no idea what we're talking about, that we're winging it. I think that is not only unfair, it's dangerous, because people who have to run, again, our diplomatic establishment, the national security establishment, the people who have to make the United States function, even in something as simple as getting a letter across the ocean or letting you being able to make a long-distance phone call, these are all things that require a lot of expertise and not just technical expertise.
Yeah. So I'm curious, though. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we're at this moment, which I'd love to discuss with you. I mean, obviously, the internet is one of them. Governmental failure in several areas is another, which I want to talk about. But I do want to ask you first, I mean, is this really any different than, you know, other periods in American history where there's been a surge of anti-intellectualism? I mean, the know-nothings came right out of New England.
Yep.
And you even quote Richard Hofstadter's work from half a century ago about how intellectuals are fiercely resented because their expertise is needed too much.
Yes. And the thing that's different, and that is an important thing to note, that, you know, people have never liked professors. You know, if you're in my line of work and you don't like getting zinged about being a professor, get into another line of work.
We like that. We wouldn't have a show without them, to be honest. But,
you know, there's always been some tension between the ordinary citizen and, you know, intellectuals or pointy heads or professionals or people with a lot of achievement in a particular area. What's different now is that people are not just skeptical about professionals. They believe themselves to be their peers, that they will actually lecture experts in a particular field. You know, my own background in Russia and foreign affairs, you know, people literally, and this predates the internet. I mean, this goes back some time. I think it's not that new a phenomenon in American life. But what is new is people saying, you know a lot about Russia? Well, let me explain Russia to you. Hmm. Or a doctor. Well, you're a doctor? Let me explain what I know about surgery to you. And that's different. This, and the word I use throughout the book is narcissism. The thing that has really fueled this death of expertise problem is a growing narcissism in the American public among a people who believe that they are that they can't never get anything wrong, that they can never be told they're wrong, and have a very thin skin about ever being corrected or told that someone else might know more than they do.
Right. And so just to be clear, when we say death of expertise, what you're really talking about is the death in the trust or belief in the value of expertise.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but I'm curious about this question of why the narcissism, to use your phrase, seems to be at a peak, or maybe not a peak, but surging now. I mean, should we look to the internet and the echo chamber that the internet can form or easily becomes as fuel for that?
The internet and cable television in particular have become enablers or energizers for this kind of narcissism, because we are inclined, because of those technological achievements, to spend less and less time with each other. And the more time you spend alone and the more time you spend only listening to views you agree with, the more brittle and narcissistic you become. But it does, I think it does predate this, and I think some of it is a disease of affluence. I think some of it is a disease of prosperity.
Meaning what? What do you mean by that?
Well, by I think, for example, looking around at the level, the standard of living the average American has, I always find it remarkable when people say, well, you know, the experts have done nothing for us. And, you know, this is the word younger students will sometimes say to me, Professor, you don't understand. This is the worst time ever. And
you maybe know, in with, their lives.
In their lives, exactly. And, you know, I look back, you know, I'm not an old man, but I've lived through some worse times than what we're living through now. And I think at that point, you look for somebody to blame. And I'm very concerned that this dovetails with our politics, that we're all about scapegoating and finding excuses for, you know, our own problems, and experts who are always far away and nobody you happen to know personally always make for a good people to blame, always make for a good scapegoat in that situation.
So in your book, you point out that one of the things about the internet and social media is that it allows people to confuse the ease with which they can collect facts with actual expertise.
Yeah, the metaphor that I use in the book is people who think they're smart after surfing the web for a long time are like people who feel like they're good swimmers because they got wet walking through a rainstorm. Simply letting facts wash over you with dozens and dozens of mouse clicks is not the same thing as learning anything. And it's actually quite disturbing to find that now educators and psychologists are looking into this and finding that, in fact, clicking through stories and blowing through web pages can actually make you stupider than when you started, that you will actually know less because the things you do know are more likely to be wrong. Because you have no way to discriminate between good information and bad information, especially at the speed of rapid clicking through pages. So in some ways, we are actually worse off for this deluge of information.
Right. And then you also write about how there are certain cognitive, I don't know what to call them, cognitive truths about how our brains work that make this problem even worse, right? Like you point to studies that say that have found that the less people know about a subject, the more confident they are that their opinion is the right one, and the more fiercely they hold on to their opinion.
Yes, this is credit where it's due. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And social psychologists have found that the people who are least able to recognize their errors tend to be the people who think they're the best at what they're doing. It's kind of like somebody who's a really bad singer and doesn't know it because they can't hear the bad notes. The same applies to knowledge or writing. People who are bad writers don't think they're bad writers because they lack the ability to see how poorly they actually write. Some of that's just hardwired into our brains. We like to hear that we're right. We want other human beings to respect us. We don't like being told we're wrong. There's no human being who really enjoys the experience of finding out that they're terribly wrong about something.
So I do want to talk in a moment about your fears for democracy here, but let me push back for a second and say that if indeed there is this collective distrust of expertise right now in amongst the American people, that maybe they have reason. They have reason to feel a profound sense of distrust. I mean, here's a small list. None of these are going to come as a surprise to you. The Iraq War. Let's reach back a little further. Gulf of Tonkin. Let's reach back a little further. what is it, 40 years of experiments on African-American men with the Tuskegee experiments being lied to by people in white coats. Okay, let's move forward in time. 2008, the financial crisis, predatory lending, so-called experts in the world of finance saying we're going to make the economy go gangbusters when instead they just dropped a nuclear bomb into the middle of it. Of course people are going to distrust experts.
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book on when the experts are wrong. And I talk about not just bad calls, but also the problem, you know, one that you didn't bring up, falsification, plagiarism, fraud. I mean, experts are human beings. You know, there are lousy airline pilots in the world who have crashed airplanes. But nonetheless, you still trust pilots to fly the plane rather than your Aunt Rose. Unless she's a pilot.
But what I'm getting at is that I feel like there has been a cascade of systemic failures that people are sensitive to.
But what the public calls failures, there's a problem here because in many of these cases, the public calls these failures because they don't want to remember their own part in it. With the 2003 Gulf War, for example, it's easy to forget that international relations, academic international relations experts took out a full-page ad. Now, I was not one of them. But my colleagues out there took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying this is a bad idea. It's only in retrospect that the populist answer is, well, we were all against it. And, well, the fact of the matter is we weren't all against it. And George Bush was reelected in 2004. People have brought up Vietnam.
But wait, hang on. One one-page ad in the New York Times does not balance out an onslaught of national security experts saying there are WMD in Iraq. I mean, these are people that people are supposed to trust.
I mean, first of all, I was
intelligence.
I was one of the people involved in that public debate, and I made a bad call because I thought Saddam Hussein was acting like he had WMD. The question is, were these experts – first of all, the most important thing is there was not a consensus of expert opinion that people are now retroactively pointing to saying all you experts told us. There were fierce arguments among experts. There were blood-on-the-floor arguments about experts. And my point is we were all trying to do our best to get to the truth. The other problem, I think, is that when you remember the populist alternatives to these – I mean, one of the reasons the 2002 Gulf War, when I was dealing with folks who were calling me about it, were asking me things like, why isn't Saddam Hussein already dead? Why didn't we kill him in 1991? And, you know, these are people that said, I want to have a very important voice in the debate, but I didn't realize that Saddam Hussein has been alive for the past 10 years. What I was going to reach back to was Vietnam, which, of course, the best and the brightest. People forget that at the time, one of the popular alternatives going all the way back to Goldwater was let's use nuclear weapons. The experts were the ones saying, maybe let's not. Let's not go down that road. And I think for every expert failure, you have to first understand that it's very rare that that failure was the product of a consensus, although the last election in polling is a good example where all the experts were like, oh, we're all pretty sure how this is going to go, and they were all surprised. Do those expert communities try to correct themselves? Are they more right than wrong? Because this is something I bring up in the book. I don't say that experts are always right or that you should trust them unquestioningly. I simply say they're more likely to be right than a layperson. And I think that's an important distinction.
Is another part of the problem here what feels like, and whether it's true or not, what feels like a decoupling of the world of expertise from the experience of everyday people? And here's what I mean. Like, for example, you know, every time we talk about numbers like GDP or the rate of growth of the economy or wages or whatever, we kind of talk about them in macro terms and we're like, hey, GDP went up 2% or whatever. But there are people who on the ground are saying, well, that's great, except in reality, I haven't seen any difference in my life whatsoever. So we're awash in a world of expertise that's almost out of context for individuals.
But there's a couple of problems there. One is, and for this I put the blame squarely on the shoulders of the ordinary citizen. If you really want to be connected to that kind of expertise and understand it better, people have to do a better job of keeping themselves informed. I don't think WBUR listeners are mostly the problem, to tell you the truth. If somebody takes the time to listen to public radio and a discussion like this, they're probably staying up on a lot of this data. But it is amazing, and I talk about these incidents in the book, people who have very strong opinions about what we should do in Ukraine and have no idea where Ukraine is. Can't even – the average respondent, when asked to point to it on a map, was off by 1,800 miles. The other problem is the, I think, increasingly unreasonable expectations of what experts can do or what expertise can accomplish. Because the kind of thing you're talking about is a confirmation bias problem, right? I mean, I was here in Boston years ago when we were actually undergoing a labor shortage. I remember fast food restaurants saying, we'll pay you to ride the bus. We'll pay you for the time you leave the house to come work for us because we'd had such a tight labor market in Boston. But that doesn't help the one guy who is always going to step forward and say, well, that's all great news, but I don't have a job.
Yeah.
And therefore, everybody's wrong. That's classic. That's a classic problem of confirmation bias to say, you know, and it works in the other way, too. When you say, well, the economy is really terrible, but somebody says, well, you know, I'm doing OK. So the economy can't be that bad. People have a tendency, and it is that, as we were talking about earlier, it's that normal human tendency to say whatever is happening to me is the world. And I think experts are – their our job is to dispassionately push back against that to say there is a bigger picture. There are bigger things to think about. Not everything is about you or what you're experiencing at that moment. That reality is bigger than that.
But shouldn't experts, while pushing back, also try harder to connect their expertise to the – I mean, you can't connect it to the individual experience of more than 300 million Americans, but try harder to put their expertise in a context where the people absorbing it can see its relevance to their daily lives.
I say at the end of the book, experts have to stop talking just to each other.
Yeah.
They have pulled back from – and in part, you know, I'm going to speak up for the experts here and say, you know, that the part of the reason experts have pulled back is they would say – look, we land 100,000 flights safely every day, and all you remember is the one plane crash. Nonetheless, I think experts also are just more comfortable talking to other experts in their specialized jargon, in their very narrow band of knowledge. And I think, yeah, there is a good case to be made that doing that enough, we start to lack empathy. I think particularly, for example, in my field, I write a lot about nuclear weapons, and I sometimes have to step back to remember that we use this very clinical language about potentially something that could end human existence. And it's good to stop every now and then to say, wait a minute, when we're talking about a bomb that can destroy, you know, 800,000 people in 30 seconds, we really have to remember the human dimension. With that said, I think people are going to have to accept what we say a little bit more dispassionately. It's you're not going to have a productive conversation with an expert if an expert says, here's the unemployment rate, and someone says, well, I'm unemployed, so I don't care what the real rate is.
Right.
I don't want to have that discussion.
So we have just under a minute to go here. Last question for you. Do you think really, or maybe in amongst all this darkness in this conversation, is there's a candle of hope that we have been through periods of time before where, again, back where we started, where there was rising anti-intellectual, but the Republic survived.
Yes. Well, let me take a let me say one positive thing, but then and say that, yes, the Republic, I have a great amount of faith in the enduring ability of our institutions, but I'm very concerned that sometimes it takes a crisis or something terrible before people understand the importance of expert knowledge. People don't want to talk to doctors until their fever hits 102, and then they rediscover the importance of medical expertise. So I'm hoping we can do something before that happens.
Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. His new book is titled The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Would love to have you back sometime soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.